Talking about fun things to do in our Carolina outdoors is one thing, but talking to people who are creative and making creative things, not just for recreation, but also tools, is another thing that we like to do here on the Carolina outdoors. It makes it all the more fun when these people are local. So we're going to stay in Mecklenburg County on this segment of the Carolina Outdoors to talk about a craftsman in our area and what that craftsman creates for people all over the country. Hi, everyone. I'm Bill Barty. This is the Carolina Outdoors. Wes Lawson is right here beside me. Wes, it's great to have you in here, especially with what we're going to talk about next.
Bill, it is good to be here talking about this. You know, I don't consider myself fully dressed until I have a pocket knife or something like that on or about my person. So this is going to be pretty good.
That's right. So we're talking about some knives, but more than just knives, historically accurate and handmade knives or broadswords or dirks or skindoos. Yeah, we're going to the high country and then some of Scotland, and we're going there with someone from Menhill, North Carolina. The head of Scotia Metalworks, J. Michael McCray, is joining us here on the Carolina Outdoors. Mike McCray, welcome.
Thanks, Bill. It's good to be here.
Well, first off, tell us how easy it is to make a knife.
Oh, man. It's as easy as you want it to be. It is nothing, the way I do it, it's nothing but hard, dirty work. All of my blades are forged, meaning that I take a hammer to hot steel and beat it to shape on an anvil. And once I've got it shaped like I want it, I have to grind it and then heat treat it and assemble it with whatever kind of handle I'm doing for it. I make a lot of historical pieces, mainly Scottish pieces from the period of 1675 to about 1750. But like anybody else that makes knives, I'll do a hatchet or a fillet knife or whatever it takes to keep me busy.
Well, you know what? I want to ask you a little bit about that because we have some of these blades at Jesse Brown's and then some. I mean, you make all kinds of different things. It's not just sharp things, although that is your specialty, but they are period pieces. People can come by Jesse Brown's and see them. They can check them out on our website, but it's more special to see them in person. These are, for the most part, period blades for different intents, whether it be warfare, whether it be personal protection. And the way they wore these different blades with their different outfits, and whether it be a kilt or what are those sashes called that the Scottish people wore, how they had those places to tuck these things in, these are the knives that they would have carried back then.
That's correct. The dirk, the big knife with 12, 13 inches or so of blade, was like the American Express card of the Highlands. You didn't leave home without it. The little one, the skindoo, today it's carried tucked in the top of your sock when you wear a kilt. You hear all kinds of nonsense about how it's a weapon of last resort. No, it wasn't. You could use it for that, but it was a pocket knife, and you just used it for whatever you'd use a knife for. I carry one of my own blades when I go fishing. And it's a nice little knife. It does exactly what a knife is supposed to, and a knife is not meant to pry the lids off of paint cans or to be used as a piton. It's meant to cut.
Yeah, TJ.
So, Mike, earlier when you were talking about how this is, you know, you are beating this metal in submission. Over the last couple of years, as people have seen more shows and videos of knife makers, and the internet has brought customers closer to knife makers, we've all kind of become Saturday evening quarterbacks with this stuff. But you use some really great high carbon steels, but one is a made in-house Damascus steel. Can you talk about how you fashion that steel and why that steel is so sought after?
Okay. There was a time not too long ago when the process for making what we call Damascus steel, which more properly should be called pattern welded steel. The concept of how to make it was considered to be lost. And back in the early 70s, a fellow named Bill Moran ran across the concept and ran with it, and he brought Damascus back to the public. It is a laminated steel. You take two different types of steel and stack them up, alternating layers, and weld them together with high heat and a hammer. When I say high heat, I'm talking about upwards of 1600-1800 degrees. It is incandescent when it comes out of the forge. And it's not just a glue job that takes place there. It's actually a molecular exchange that causes it to become one solid bar of steel. Now, once you've got that first bunch of layers welded together, you stretch it out by using high heat and the hammer, and you fold it back on itself. The blade that is most often associated with that folding process is the Japanese sword. Well, you fold it, and you weld it together with high heat and a hammer, and you fold it, and you do this until you have the number of layers that you want, and I usually shoot for around 300. Then, after you've got that piece of bar stock made, comes the work of turning it into a knife. Now, all other things being equal, a Damascus blade and a simple high carbon steel blade will perform equally well. It's just that Damascus is heirloom quality stuff, and plain steel is everyday carry. Now, you hear, once again, all kinds of nonsense about how you can get a piece of Damascus so sharp that you can drop a silk scarf on it and it will cut it in two. Well, that may be, but I think that's probably an apocryphal tale. You can make them sharp, but I don't know that you can make them that sharp.
Well, yours are definitely sharp. We have that on good authority at Jesse Brown's. And if you're just joining us here on the Carolina Outdoors, the voice on the phone, our guest, J. Michael McCray of Scotial Metalwork, is joining the outdoor guys, Wes Lawson, Bill Barty, and we're talking historically accurate, handmade broadswords, dirks, skeen doos, and more on the program. And, Mike, I don't know how many years you've been doing it, but you have acquired and created quite a shop located here in Mecklenburg County to make these. You make this stuff on premise. And it includes the hammers that you use, the forge, the press that you have. What else does it take for this creation? And after you answer that, I'm going to ask you another question about upcoming knife makers.
I'm not sure how to answer that question, Bill. There's very little that one needs in the way of equipment to become a bladesmith. You need a hammer. You need something to forge into a knife, i.e. the piece of steel. You need a heat source. You need something to beat it on. I use a 200-year-old anvil. And then you need files and sandpaper and that kind of thing to clean it up and make it shiny.
So after you've pounded this piece of hot metal, which is orange and red and then black, your work is polished by the time it reaches Jesse Brown's. How do you get it from being so hot to so beautiful, beautifully polished inside a store like that?
Well, it just takes, frankly, it just takes a lot of cussed old hard-headedness. you have to file it to make it flat and smooth, or sand it. I use a belt sander. It runs a belt 2 inches wide by 72 inches long. You sand it. Then almost every one of the knives that I make is hand sanded to some degree or another. meaning just that. You take a piece of sandpaper and you wrap it around a flat stick and you work on your blade with that. And the reason that I'm so particular about the finish on my blades is one of the guys that I learned the business from, I showed him a knife that I was finishing up, and he said, okay, what do you think of it? And I said, well, I don't know where to go from here. And he said, ask yourself this, would you buy a knife that looked like that? And I thought about it a minute, and he said, if it doesn't have any scratches in it, and if all of your sanding marks run in one direction, you're done. But would you buy a knife across the counter somewhere that had grind marks in it? Well, I took that to heart. That's the way I look at it today.
So, Mike, we have in our display case one of your knives I don't think is actually on your website. It's called the Little Stubby Skinner, and it is a fascinating
Stubby Skinner.
It is a neat little knife. It, you know, I've been around knives and skinning knives for a long, long time, but I've never seen one that fits so naturally in the hand and is so crazy sharp. How did you come to create that little gem? It really is a fascinating little knife.
I was at the Blade Show in Atlanta one year, and I saw a knife that had that silhouette. The whole knife was about 5/8 of an inch thick at the handle. And I picked it up, and I looked at it, and I said, dang, this is a nice knife. And I came home, and I mulled this thing over, and I said, you know, I think I can improve on this. So I made the handle bulbous, so it fits into the cup of the palm of your hand. And then you lay your index finger along the back of the blade, and it will guide you into places you don't even have to see and know you're not going to cut anything that you don't want to.
Yeah, it is the most, you know, ergonomically correct knife I think I've ever put in my hand.
And that big belly on the thing makes separating a deer from his hide easy.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
As easy as it's going to get. But, so, yeah, that's one of my best sellers.
That's a great little knife. Now, that's far from the Jacobite tradition of knives. How did you land on the Jacobite tradition? What brought you to that as your inspiration?
I backed into it. I was a custom order jeweler, and I had made an occasional knife over the years. And one Christmas, a lady came in my shop, and she wanted to sell me advertising and the program of a Scottish Highland Games, and something clicked. And I said, you know, I think I'd like to try this. And I said, sure, I'd like to put an ad in there, and I'd like information on how to become a vendor. And that opened up an entirely new can of worms. Hmm. The upshot being, but I only took a couple of knives to my first Highland Games. I sold pretty quick, and that indicated to me that I needed to reassess the jewelry business and how it relates to the knife business. And here I am today. Once in a while, I'll make a piece of jewelry, but most of what I do these days is sharp.
It is sharp, and if you're just joining us, J. Michael McCray of Scotia Metalwork is joining us here on the Carolina Outdoors with Wes Lawson, Bill Barty. Over at Jesse Brown's, we have a lot of these knives on display. So you can come by the store, check them out. Of course, his website, scotiametalwork.com, you can see it there. Mike, who buys these knives?
Well, for years I have made my living off of the Scottish community up and down the East Coast. Every weekend, well, until the COVID virus knocked us on our butts, every weekend during the year from the second week of January to the first week of December, there's Highland Games somewhere in this country. On the East Coast, the most famous and recognizable happens at Grandfather Mountain in July. There's one in Huntersville every spring. But I kind of backed into it, and having done some research into my family, I realized that we come from a spot in Scotland that is the most photographed castle in Scotland, including Edinburgh Castle, and that is Ellendonan Castle, the ancestral home of the Clan MacRae. I focus on this mainly because that's how it paid my bills for a lot of years. When I first got into it, I did it because it was a nod to my Scottish heritage. And everybody that knows me knows what I think of that, which is I wouldn't take anything in the world for it. But now when I make a piece, it's because I'm generally these days, it's because I'm making it for somebody that has a connection to tartan fabric and the bagpipes.
Well,
I'm aware. Go ahead.
I was going to say, as you're doing this, and Wes alluded to this earlier, there's this community of knife makers coming up behind you, somewhat mainstream. Do you have any advice for them if they're just making it for themselves or their family or in the garage, in the shop, in the kitchen, wherever they may be making their own knives, just like that knife maker gave you advice? Do you have any view of the current up-and-coming young knife maker and any advice for that knife maker?
The advice would be do the best you can do every time you do it. Every single time you make a knife, make it as good as you can make it. Now, early on, that's not going to be all that great. Stay with it anyway. It will get better as time goes by. There are no shortcuts. Don't try to take shortcuts that aren't there. Be true to your own vision of what this knife ought to look like. Now, there are knives out there that will cut like crazy that look like they were designed by a four-year-old. There are things out there that are just absolutely gorgeous that feel like a brick when you pick them up because they're not proportioned right. Do the best you can do. The best you can do today might not be all that great, but tomorrow it will be better. Make it the best you can. That's my two cents worth of advice.
Well, with that being said, knife making could equal life lessons, both being the same. So you may have taught us a little bit more beyond just making something sharp. You may have taught us something that we can all strive for moving forward in whatever that we do. J. Michael MacRae, Scotia Metalwork, thank you for being on the Carolina Outdoors and talking to us about it.
Hey, guys, thank you for having me. This has been fun.
It's a blast. Off he goes, J. Michael MacRae of Scotia Metalwork, historically accurate, handmade broadswords, dirks, skeen doos, and more. We have them in the showcase at Jesse Brown, so you can stop by and check them out. But be careful, because they are sharp. We're going to take a quick break. He's Wes Lawson. I'm Bill Barty. You're listening to the Carolina Outdoors.